This is edition 1972 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 20th of June 2025. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 19th of June 2025. My name is Simon Musto-Arthur and my fellow readers are
Debs Hall,
Delia Malam,
Bo Williams.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise at around 4:30 a.m. and will set at about 9 p.m. Also, if anyone is having a birthday this week, the team here at the Mardler would like to wish you a very happy birthday. We also welcome new listener Helen from Holt. And the Mardler Annual General Meeting will be held on Saturday the 28th of June in the Methodist Hall, 26 White Hart Street, Aylsham, NR11 6HG. Tea and coffee will be served from 10 a.m. with the meeting starting at 10:30 a.m. All Mardler listeners and volunteers are welcome.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes disappearing furniture and contents, reappearing mangrove swamps, as well as a visit to a quiet place in the centre of busy London and an insight into the 8 UK members of the Corvid family of birds. Maybe you can already name all 8 before we get to the magazine section?
But we begin with the main news items, which include a woman being hit with a £24,000 energy bill on a property which is hardly used, news regarding Felbrigg Hall, a film set in a fictional Norfolk, Lincolnshire border town recognised with a BAFTA, and an owl entangled in fishing line makes a miraculous recovery. Let's start with those lead stories.
A 70-year-old woman says she is on the brink of financial ruin after being hit with an eye-watering £24,000 energy bill for a property that stands empty for much of the year. Lynn Lawler, who owns Grange Farmhouse in Hainford, uses the 5-bedroom house and adjoining annex as a holiday rental for just over 100 days a year. But despite the limited use over the last 2 years, energy supplier Smartest Energy has issued a bill for £24,010 for a year and will cut off her power unless she agrees to pay it back at £2,022 per week. Ms. Lawler said, "I just can't afford it. They've got their hands around my throat and in my pocket." Ms. Lawler was stunned when she started receiving monthly bills totalling thousands of pounds, and complained numerous times to the company's customer service team. In February of this year, the company charged her £3,217 for a month's worth of electricity. Finally, she says a customer service call handler slipped up by admitting that the company was unable to communicate with her smart meter. In October 2024, engineers were called out to inspect the meter. Ms. Lawler recalled, "One of them said the readings were like that of a factory and I should only be paying about £200 a month, not thousands. He said he was condemning the meter as it was faulty and not communicating properly." The meter was replaced in March and her bills immediately dropped. This May she was charged £183 compared to £1,675 the year before. However, Smartest Energy is still demanding the full £24,000, has cancelled her new, cheaper contract and installed a prepayment meter. Ms. Lawler said, "If they cut me off, I'll lose my bookings, my income, everything. They'll bankrupt me." Broadland and Fakenham MP Jerome Mayhew called it a crazy case and pledged to support Ms. Lawler. He said, "I have contacted Smartest Energy to make sure that this case is properly investigated and my team will continue to support Ms. Lawler until she gets a successful resolution." Smartest Energy and the Energy Ombudsman were both approached for comment. In an email to Ms. Lawler sent on Tuesday, Smartest Energy said all bills were adequate and for her to provide photos of her new and old meters.
Felbrigg Hall, near Cromer, will be undergoing essential work to ensure its preservation for future generations. The National Trust has been given the go-ahead to replace part of the stately home's roof to protect the historic building from rain damage. The work to the building will focus on the south corridor roof in the estate's service wing, a Grade 2 listed section. The current roof design causes rainwater to flow back towards the main building, which has led to leaks, blocked gutters and damage to plaster inside. The new plan will reverse the slope of the roof so that the water drains away from the hall instead. As well as replacing the roof, the project includes new drainage systems, structural repairs, and the temporary installation of a visitor welcome hub whilst work is being carried out. Some original materials, like roof slates and brickwork, will need to be removed, but the Trust says this is necessary to stop further damage caused by water. Felbrigg Parish Council and Historic England have both said they have no objections to the plans. North Norfolk District Council planning officers decided the proposed work would respect the building's heritage and meets local conservation policies. Felbrigg Hall has a long and rich history. The main house was built around 1621 and was owned by the Wyndham family for generations. In 1969, the estate was gifted to the National Trust by its last private owner, Robert Wyndham Ketton Creamer, known locally as the Last Squire. Set in 500 acres of parkland, Felbrigg Hall is considered one of East Anglia's most beautiful country houses. It contains rare furniture, artworks and Chinese wallpaper dating back to 1752. And while the corridor roof is not part of the main Grade 1 listed hall, it still holds historic importance.
An upcoming feature film starring award-winning actors was shot in several locations around Norfolk. Chicken Town, a new comedy film, will be released in UK cinemas on June the 27th after a world premiere at Cinema City in Norwich on June 17th. The film has been written and directed by Norwich local Richard Bracewell and produced by Tom Wood, also from the city. Set in a fictional town on the Norfolk-Lincolnshire border, Chicken Town tells the story of two school friends in a dead-end town in the east of England. They find themselves joining forces with a green-fingered grandad to sell a shed of weed that the old man has accidentally grown on his allotment. It has been revealed that several BAFTA award-winning actors have fronted the cast, which was filmed in several locations around Norfolk. Keen-eyed viewers might recognise the old Catton Morrisons, Helston Allotments and Causton Village. Heading up the cast is Graham Fellows, who plays the elderly man and accidental weed cultivator, Kev Madams. Fellows is the creator of comedy character John Shuttleworth and has played all the characters in the longest-running BBC radio sitcom The Shuttleworths. As a voice artist, he provided the voices for the BAFTA-winning Stage Fright, made by Aardman, and he has also been seen in Coronation Street and Heartbeat. He is joined by Lawrence Rickard, the BAFTA award-winning writer and actor behind Horrible Histories. Rickard is the co-writer of Amandaland and starred in BBC sitcom Ghosts, as well as Paddington 2 and Chicken Run Dawn of the Nugget. He plays Grebo Mechanic in Chicken Town, joined by comedian and actor Alistair Green as Mr. Green. Green has starred in This Time with Alan Partridge, Ted Lasso and Stath Let's Flats and has a large presence on social media, where he posts comedy sketches to his hundreds of thousands of followers. Athaniel Davey, star of Hollyoaks, will play Jace, who is released from prison at the start of the film for a crime he didn't commit.
12-year-old Henry Gill spotted a Dricken Owl on Wednesday afternoon while walking with his father Mike at Pretty Corner Woods near Sheringham. Mr. Gill took photos and posted them on a local Facebook group, writing, "Not very nice pics, but didn't know where else to report. There is a small owl tangled on fishing line across the lake up Pretty Corner. Unfortunately, it's already passed away." His post sparked anger online, with locals demanding greater responsibility from anglers to clear up after themselves. But in a surprising turn of events, another member of the public managed to reach the owl and discovered it was still alive. The bird, a small female tawny owl, was rushed to Phoenix Bird of Prey Rescue Centre. Joe Daffin, founder and chief rehabber at the charity, said, "She's doing really well. The fishing line, unfortunately, got wrapped around her wing and foot, clamping them together. We've removed the line and she's on antibiotics while her wounds heal. We're hoping to release her next week." The owl is also believed to be a mother, with chicks waiting for her in the wild. Miss Daffin added, "She has a brood spot, which means she's recently been nesting. But the chicks should have already fledged the nest, and Dad should be helping to look after them." Miss Daffin said the charity also recently rescued another tawny owl found tangled in fishing line in a tree above a pond in Cossey near Norwich. She added, "We've had multiple tawny owls caught in fishing line. Multiple. Some of them we can't save, sadly, because the injuries are too severe. If you do fish around waterways or find fishing line, please pick it up and take it home and help protect our wildlife."
John Rampling has been awarded the British Empire Medal for services to the communities of Aylmerton and Holt. A dedicated member of Holt's Rotary Club, Mr. Rampling is well known for his community work. He made headlines last year when, at the age of 84, he joined two fellow retirees, Rod Hunt, 85, and Henry Kilvert, 70, for a two-day charity kayaking challenge along the River Wensum. Calling themselves the Three Old Men in Boats, the trio raised more than £14,000 for the rural mental health charity YANA, You Are Not Alone, paddling nearly 100 miles from Sculthorpe Mill to Pull's Ferry in Norwich. Mr. Rampling was previously chairman of Aylmerton Parish Hall and played a key role in securing the village's first welcome sign. Reflecting on his community work, he said, "It's been a privilege to work with the community in Aylmerton to help improve amenities and encourage pride in our village. When we downsized and moved to Holt in 2014, somehow much the same thing has happened, largely through Holt Rotary, where innovation has been the word." Margaret Sheelan Cuthbert, a former headmistress from Holt, has been awarded a BEM for services to the community in North Norfolk. British Empire medals are awarded for exceptional contributions at a local level and are presented by Lord Lieutenants on behalf of the King. The honours lists celebrate individuals who have demonstrated commitment, leadership and dedication to public service, with many nominations coming from members of the public.
Tim Ballard has been a volunteer with Cromer RNLI for 13 years, serving in various roles, including helm on the boat station's inshore lifeboat navigator, crew member on the all-weather lifeboat, and shore crew. He is now officially qualified as a mechanic on the station's Tamar-class all-weather lifeboat. Mr. Ballard said, "It's a real honour to step into the role of mechanic. I've learned so much from the crew here at Cromer, and it's great to be able to contribute in a new way. The lifeboat means a lot to the town, and to be trusted with helping to keep her running smoothly is something I'm really proud of." John Redmond, Cromer RNLI Lifeboat Operations Manager, said, "We're thrilled for Tim. Becoming a lifeboat mechanic is no small feat. It takes technical knowledge, commitment, and the ability to stay calm under pressure. Tim embodies everything the RNLI stands for. Mr. Ballard will play a key role in ensuring the readiness, safety, and performance of the Tamar lifeboat."
The monthly drop-in sessions at Sheringham Salvation Army in Cramer Street will be run by Age UK Norfolk from June. People who attend the sessions will be able to get advice on a range of issues, including healthcare, welfare benefits and planning for later life. Emma Harkness, Head of Information and Advice at Age UK Norfolk, said, "We know that many older people prefer to speak to someone in person, especially when it comes to sensitive or complex issues. These new sessions will bring trusted expert advice directly into the heart of communities where we're seeing real need." The charity, which said it was able to provide the service thanks to funding from the Sir Martin Lang Fund, hopes to extend to other areas in North Norfolk. Age UK Norfolk also runs a telephone advice line for older people in need of support, which can be accessed by phoning 0300 500 1217. The drop-in sessions at the Sheringham Salvation Army will run from 10 a.m. until 12 p.m. on the following Thursday mornings: July the 3rd, September the 4th, October the 2nd and December the 4th.
Demi Trenholm, a member of the Cromer RNLI Shore Crew and Visits team, took part in the charity's May Day Mile Challenge throughout May, raising funds to support the RNLI's life-saving work. Miss Trenholm said, "It's been a fantastic challenge to take part in, and it's given me a great reason to get outside and be active every day in May. By raising vital funds, you can help us continue our life-saving work." Her 57-mile effort included swimming at Trimmingham Leisure Club, paddleboarding at Go Paddle in Horning, and walks across various locations in Norfolk, finishing with a park run on May the 31st. John Redmond, Lifeboat Operations Manager at Cromer RNLI, said, "We are incredibly grateful to Demi for taking the time to participate in the challenge, which helps raise vital funds for the charity. She is a valued member of the RNLI family at Cromer in her roles of shore crew and the visits team. Well done, Demi." And The Telegraph has released a list of the top five coastal destinations chosen by author Roger Morgan Grenville, who traversed the 11,000-mile coastline by foot, bus, train and hitchhiking. The journey took 18 months and started at Cape Roth Lighthouse, right at the very northern tip of Scotland, from where Morgan Grenville travelled anti-clockwise around the country. North Norfolk really stood out to the author, who visited in the depths of winter. "I saw wildfowl flocks flying in from the sea roosts to the beet fields just inland," he said. "It was a magnificent sight. To watch 70,000 pink-footed geese in flight is to understand in an instant how things once were and how they could be again." Also on the list were Penzance in Cornwall, Knoydart in Scotland, Cardigan Bay in Wales, and some of Britain's most desolate islands, including Iona, Bardsey and Lindisfarne.
The third branch of a local coffee business has opened in a North Norfolk town. Folks Coffee Company has branched out into Holt and launched at 8 Fish Hill, the former home of Starplane Stores. Business owner Harry Vergerson said, "Holt felt like a natural next step for Folks Coffee Company, full of character, close to the coast and with a strong sense of community. After the success of our Blakeney Cafe, which has become a go-to for coastal coffee, expanding into Holt made perfect sense. We're looking forward to becoming part of Holt's daily rhythm. From morning coffees to laid-back evenings, we aim to offer a warm, welcoming space that people return to, whether for a quick sandwich, a pastry, or a glass of wine after work." The brand also runs a cafe in Blakeney and the bakery in Hayden, after starting life as a coffee shop in Yalm Food Hall in Norwich's Royal Arcade in November 2022. However, it is no longer in the city. Holt is the third town where the company has opened a site in as many years. Mr. Vergerson explained, "We've grown thoughtfully, one location at a time. Every move reflects our values, community, sustainability and quality. Folks has always been about more than coffee. It's about creating spaces people genuinely enjoy." The Holt store will be more than just a standard coffee shop, with a pop-up shop space and plans for evening dining too. Holt will offer coffee, cakes and sandwiches by day, and wine, charcuterie and cheese by night, Mr. Ferguson added. It's inspired by the cafes we love, places that shift with the day but always feel like home. The launch date for our evening service is coming soon. We love pop-ups as a way to collaborate and keep things fresh. We're starting in Holt with Flint Finds, vintage clothing specialists with a focus on curated, sustainable fashion. More creative partnerships are on the way.
Each year, the travel website TripAdvisor celebrates travellers' favourite hotels based on ratings and reviews collected over a 12-month period. The Manor Coastal Hotel, which is situated in Blakeney, was the only Norfolk establishment to make the 25 strong list of top hotels in the whole of the UK. The team was unaware of the accomplishment until it appeared in the media. Senior General Manager Greg Dover said, "We weren't expecting it at all. It wasn't a goal of ours or something we realistically thought we could achieve. But we do strive to keep our guest base on TripAdvisor as customer-focused as possible. Being listed alongside long-standing businesses, we feel very honoured and humbled that our little North Norfolk hotel featured. It is not the first time the hotel has received an accolade, as in 2024 it won the Hotel of the Year from the Coaching Inn Group. This comes after the establishment underwent a full renovation after being purchased by the company in June 2022. Our interior and location are great, but the overwhelming factor that is making us consistent over the last 3 years is our team and ethos," Mr. Dover added. "If not broken, don't change it. It is great to get these lovely accomplishments, but you have to remember what got you there. Our loyal customer base puts us in this position."
Blakeney Point has featured in Country Living's top 5 seaside walks in the UK, which outlines the best spots from the south coast of Scotland for a coastal wander. The 4-mile shingle and sand dune spit is part of the Blakeney National Nature Reserve. It has been managed by the National Trust since 1912 and is home to England's largest grey seal colony. The article says, "The coastline in this East Anglian county is renowned for its big skies and exceptional wildlife. Walkers are encouraged to join the beach at Clye and walk along the shingle spit to the sand dunes near the old lifeboat station. From there, visitors can continue along the boardwalk for wonderful views of the dunes, tidal creeks and nature reserve, plus breeding birds such as terns and avocets. Also on the list are the Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland and the Fife Coastal Path in Scotland."
For the last decade, Camellia Cottage has been in the heart of Sheringham at 1 Station Road. The cafe was established in 2015 by then 21-year-old Abby Wright and has continued to offer those local to the seaside town and tourists a range of light bites, cakes and drinks. To mark the milestone, the cafe has undergone a stylish refurbishment, which features a new serving counter and a bar area. With the temperatures creeping up, the shops, courtyard and back garden, offering additional seating during the upcoming busy summer season, is now open. Donatus Laurinaitis has also joined the team as the cafe's new manager. "I'm very excited to join this lovely coastal town's vibrant community," he said. "I am looking forward to welcoming both locals and holidaymakers for evening drinks. From June the 20th to the end of September, customers will be able to enjoy a selection of alcoholic drinks and sharing platters through to 10 p.m. on Friday and Saturday."
And this next article about letters sent to and from Buxton Primary School will be followed by 2 letters sent into the paper this week. A letter was sent in March to parents of children attending Buxton Primary School from headteacher Jules Stops, informing them of the continued financial pressure that it was under. The plan put forward to start in September would see the school running from 8:10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Fridays. The school day would carry on starting at 8:10 a.m. and finishing at 3:05 for the rest of the week. The primary school claimed the timetable had been carefully arranged to ensure pupils still receive 32.5 hours of teaching per week, the minimum suggested by non-statutory governmental guidelines. Parents met with the school in May to discuss the proposal, with a third of parents for it, a third against it, and the other third undecided from the 102 families who responded. Staff working at the school were almost unanimously supportive of the change, but the debate continues. It was hoped that a final decision would be made this week, but it has now been pushed back to the end of June. The proposal, if it is approved, would then come into effect in January 2026 rather than September. One point raised by the local authority that has delayed the decision is that the school has too many staff, which is a point that the school denies. "We disagree with this position," Miss Stops said in a new letter seen by this newspaper. "It is true that Buxton has a higher than average teaching support staff, but this is more than compensated for by the fact that the school operates with the absolute minimum number of qualified teachers."
J. Ray from Aylsham writes, "There's been a lot written about the Sizewell C situation recently. Just to lighten things up, I write to share a story that someone once told me. Some years ago, because there were many men employed at Sizewell B, they decided they wanted to form a football team. They wanted to play some pre-season games, so they contacted the secretary of Distown FC asking if they could play them in a friendly. The secretary agreed, whilst asking, 'Sorry, who are you again?' The caller replied, 'Sizewell B.' With this town secretary replying, 'I think you better send your A team. Don't you know we won the FA trophy last season?'"
And from Holt Probus Club, "The club met on Wednesday 4th of June at the Feathers in Holt for their monthly gathering, lunch and talk. In August 2021, Terry Hawes was at Pinewoods in Wells when he was suddenly taken ill. He and his wife had just bought a new caravan and had travelled up to kit it out. He said, 'I was feeling a bit unwell and felt a bit faint. I did faint and I was out for a couple of seconds. East Anglian Air Ambulance landed at the caravan park in Wells. An ECG found he was having a major heart attack. He said, 'When heart attack came into my mind, I thought instant death.' He was airlifted to hospital and said the speed of the response gave him a fighting chance. At the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital, Terry was treated immediately and has made an excellent recovery. Terry is now a speaker for the air ambulance and came to tell Probus members how it all works. An entertaining and fascinating talk, for which the chairman proposed a well-deserved vote of thanks. Holt Probus Club meets on the first Wednesday each month at the Feathers Hotel in Holt. Always on the lookout for new members, any interested retired gentleman should contact Dave Wyeth at dave.wyeth, that is W-Y-E-T-H, at icloud.com, or find the club on the web at holtprobusclub.wordpress.com.
Plumpton, Jennifer Ann, Jinx. Died peacefully on June 1st, 2025. Much loved sister to Patrick, aunt to Justin and Rupert, great aunt to Joe, Lola, Arthur and Billy, and friend to all. Remembrance service at Holy Trinity Church, West Runton, Monday, June 30th at 3 p.m. No flowers, but donations, if desired, to Cancer Research UK can be made online at jinxplumpton.org. Dot, much loved. Ducker's Funeral Care, Aylsham, 01263 733 176.
You're listening to edition number 1972 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, the 20th of June, 2025. Still to come, there are news items about a local road closure, several planning submissions and outcomes to keep you informed, a family's wish to inform people of their lessons learned about the hidden implications of signing a DNR in hospital, and of course, the Mardler magazine section. But before all that, here are some local events coming up which may tempt you out and about.
What's on this week here in Norfolk? Well, on Sunday the 22nd of June, you may wish to go to the Rosary Cemetery on Rosary Road in Norwich for a tour starting at 2 p.m. where you can learn about some of the notable people buried there. Contact Mark at benthicsciences.co.uk for more details. Or you may prefer the Corn Exchange in King's Lynn at 3:30 p.m. to listen to a concert of Beethoven, Brahms and De Berio for £16 a ticket. Contact is J Burgess at nso-uk.co.uk. On Wednesday, the 25th of June at 3 p.m, a free experience at the Assembly House in Theatre Street, Norwich, allows you to find out about antiques and get free valuations from Oliver Miller. Contact alice.lofqvist at auctionnet.com. And finally, on Friday the 27th of June at 2 p.m. at Lynn Museum in King's Lynn, there is a talk on the life of a guide dog. Tickets are £2 each and you can phone 0155 377 5001 for more details.
We now turn to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, which we hope you'll enjoy. We have stories about the Archbishop of Canterbury offering a spiritual garden for MPs to connect with nature. We stay with nature and look at the downfall and the reintroduction of mangrove swamps around the globe. We also consider the differences and historical contexts of eight different species of corvid, otherwise known as the crow family. And we finish with the concept of the disappearing sideboard.
And the first piece is from the RSPB magazine of Spring-Summer 2024, written by Adrian Thomas. Less than 400 metres from the Houses of Parliament, hardly known for its wildlife riches, is a place that teems with life, the Lambeth Palace Garden. Here, the palace graciously allows the RSPB to host walks for MPs to help inspire them about nature. As well as being a private garden for the Archbishop of Canterbury, his wife Caroline, and the palace's staff and visitors, the garden also has many more equally important roles. The Archbishop likes it to be used to support worthwhile causes, explains Lambeth Palace's head gardener, Lindsay Schumann. It is one of the oldest gardens in the UK, first created in 1197, but with a long and varied history from growing food in the Middle Ages to becoming allotments in the First World War. It was then heavily bombed in the Second World War. Now it is a haven of tranquility, all managed organically. At one end of the garden is the palace, at the other the library, and in between, enjoying a sheltered microclimate thanks to the high garden walls, is, in effect, a grand woodland glade. On the central lawn, mowing is restricted, leaving as much uncut as possible, including a grass labyrinth requested by Archbishop Justin. The main lawn is needed for large events, but there are plenty of edges left. It is like the biblical principle where you have a generous margin around the edge of a field, Lindsay says. We try to be generous in everything we do in the garden. This generosity extends to the foxes which breed in the garden. We live with them, accept them. We do have to work around some of their impacts, so we mow long grass when they've run through it several times, but we raise the mower height and leave the cut area longer. Around the outside of the lawn, majestic trees soar, and there are extensive beds of flowers. We try to have as long a flowering season as possible. Snowdrops lead to daffodils, bluebells to cow parsley, and then into the main summer season. On my walks with MPs, we've seen blackcaps, goldfinches, jays and redwings. Smooth newts thrive in the simple pond in the chapel garden, while the main pond by the library throngs with common toads. Moth surveys have turned up four species of hawk moth: small elephant, pine, lime and poplar, with sightings posted on the palace's internal website to inform and enthuse staff. Meanwhile, the compost heaps are one of Lindsay's favourite areas. Compost is the unsung hero of the garden. When things die, they give to the next generation. It is what I call paying forward. The garden isn't about the pursuit of perfection, Lindsay says. It is about spirituality, and nature is a big part of that. It is hard not to be moved in a garden as it talks to your inner core. And Lindsay's top tips for a successful garden: grow what works. Plants will tell you what they like and don't like, so take your cues from the garden. Don't try to force things. If you try to control everything, you're on a hiding to nothing and end up frustrated. Have a gentle approach to your planting and a generous approach to your space. The best skill you can have in a garden is to look and listen. And last but not least, a garden is not about creating a masterpiece. It is about blending with your space, no matter its size.
From the World Wildlife Fund publication, entitled Shores and Coastlines, published for the Millennium. On the island of Panay in the Philippines, the situation used to be much the same as on other coasts. For centuries, fishermen and other coastal dwellers had lived in harmony with the mangrove forest. They were grateful for the green wall that protected them against the storms in the monsoon season. They ground the bark of the mangroves to ferment palm wine or for medicinal purposes. They cut down the timber to build their huts, and they knew that many fish had their nurseries in the mangroves. Then, however, the rapidly growing population started crowding from the hinterland to the coast. Huts made of matted grass and later shanty towns, consisting of tin huts, were built closer and closer towards the mangroves. Many of the settlers did not know what to make of the inaccessible, swampy undergrowth and the swarms of gnats. It was obviously worthless, barren land that was simply waiting to be put to meaningful use. Progress, prosperity and rice for all was the slogan. In the 1950s, the absurd consequences were that they chopped down the nurseries of many species of fish in order to make room for fish farms. In the 1980s, it was then shrimp fever, to which several hundred thousand acres of mangrove swamps fell victim. It was good for the companies that were trying to satisfy the constant rise in demand in the USA, Japan and Europe, and which earned a great deal of money in the process. it was bad for the local population, which was left a few years later with an abandoned wasteland where the soils had an excess of salt and were burdened with pesticides and disinfectants, whilst the shrimp breeders set up new aquacultures elsewhere. The well-stocked fishing grounds of yesteryear. Only the very old people can remember them. What was new, on the other hand, was the force with which storms and floods struck the now unprotected coastal strip. Perhaps a total disaster was needed in order to bring people to their senses and show them how the mangroves had in the past provided coastal protection and plenty of fish, all free of charge. Since they were no longer there, people had to begin planting them again. On the island of Pani, for example, there are a number of initiatives aimed at establishing new mangrove belts. It is laudable and perhaps a good start, but at present it is still no more than a drop in the ocean when we consider the situation worldwide. While the unique ecosystem still covers 68,000 square miles and spreads a girdle around a quarter of all the coastlines between the Tropic of Cancer in the north and the Tropic of Capricorn in the south, excavators and chainsaws are still decimating mangrove stocks whenever they are in the way of hotel facilities, marinas, roads or rice fields. Even tropical researchers and ecologists have only recently turned their attention to the muddy habitat and have been delighted by what they have found. Snails, mollusks, shrimps, fish, amphibians, snakes, crocodiles, waterfowl and waders and small mammals. In the mangroves, the inhabitants of the land and the water come face to face. The mangrove trees themselves are an example of evolutionary ingenuity. After all, they are capable of desalinating water, absorbing oxygen through aerial roots and allowing their seeds to germinate while on the mother plant.
This next article is from the Caravan and Motorhome Club magazine of January 2025 and is by David Chapman. Crows are confident, cocky and seared into our psyche, the subject of more myths and fables than any other family of birds. While we tend to disapprove of their behaviour, the crow family, which includes magpies, jays, jackdaws and choughs, as well as ravens and rooks, can never be described as uninteresting. Many crows, most notably ravens, feed on carrion. Today we might find this distasteful, but thousands of years ago our Norse ancestors revered them for that very behaviour, as they would eat the flesh of dead warriors before burial. They believed that ravens were messengers from their god Odin, and in areas of the British Isles where Norse influence was strong, such as in Orkney and Caithness, the raven was adopted as an emblem. The jay and magpie are notorious for stealing eggs from the nests of other birds, though it is the magpie that takes most of the blame, probably because its pied plumage is associated with evil and bad fortune. It is said that the magpie carries some of the devil's blood and was the only bird not to go onto the ark with Noah. Magpies are known as the thieves of the bird world. From Rossini's opera, The Thieving Magpie, to our use of magpies on posters warning about thieves operating in certain areas, this reputation is fostered to this day. The crow is usually associated with bad luck, and its name is often linked with negativity. To crow means to boast when victorious, and crow's feet refer to the lines found around our eyes as we age. Further evidence of our negativity towards crows can be found in their collective nouns. A murder of crows, a mischief of magpies, a band of jays, a clattering of jackdaws, and an unkindness of ravens. The only crow with a flattering collective noun is the chough, which collects in chatters. While it is interesting to learn about such folklore, it is important to respect crows for what they are. intelligent, adaptable and sociable. Here I offer a brief look at the 8 crow species found in this country. The largest UK representative of the crow family, the raven, is known for its wide range of distinctive, guttural croaking calls. When in flight, the raven's long, thick neck and wedge-shaped tail are clear, while it might be possible to see its huge bill when it is at rest. It is found across the whole country. In Cornish folklore, King Arthur was believed to have been reincarnated as a raven, and to harm a raven would bring bad luck. Like the raven, the carrion crow is black all over, but it is much smaller. Carrion crows are usually seen singly or in small groups. If you see a big flock of crows, they're likely to be rooks. It is likely that the saying, "stone the crows," originated in Australia, where large flocks would be stoned to scare them away from farm stock. The hooded crow only came to be regarded as a separate species from the carrion crow in 2002. Named after their black hood on a grey body, hooded crows are found in the north and west of Scotland. Originally being referred to as the chroc, the rook's name is derived from its call. Its most distinctive feature is the bald white patch around the base of the bill. It can be seen probing muddy ground for grubs of beetles such as cockchafers, which have become known as rookworms. The saying, "as the crow flies," is likely to refer to the rook, which has a very direct flight. Rooks breed in large colonies known as rookeries. These are deemed to bring good fortune, but some say it's bad luck if the birds leave. An old wives' tale is that if rooks build their nests high in the trees, we will have good weather, but if they build low down, then it will be wet and cold. The magpie is an unmistakable bird. Iridescent, pied plumage, a very long tail, magpie-related superstition and folklore, and a rhyme. One for sorrow, two for joy, three for a girl, four for a boy. 5 for silver, 6 for gold, 7 for a secret never to be told. This poem has variations, but all begin with one for sorrow. Encountering a single magpie is regarded as unlucky, but people have always believed there are ways to thwart this bad luck. I was taught to salute a single magpie to show respect, while my wife blinks, pretending to see 2 magpies. Other entertaining remedies include pinching your companion 3 times, saying, "Hello, Mr. Magpie, how is your wife?" or revolving 3 times on the spot. The jay is easily identified by its dusky pink body, black moustache and white rump, and striking flash of blue on its wings. Its loud screeching call has earned it a variety of local names, including Devil Scritch. Smaller than the carrion crow, another predominantly black bird, but a grey head, contrasts with its black face. Young jackdaws have the most beautiful eyes, their black pupils juxtaposing blue irises which fade to white as the bird ages. Finally, now pronounced chuff, it would once have been pronounced chow, alluding to the bird's call. Chuffs can be recognised by their beautiful red legs and beak and glossy black plumage. The chuff is similar in size to the jackdaw and breeds around the coast of Wales, Cornwall, Western Scotland and Ireland. It has recently been reintroduced to Kent and further reintroductions are planned.
And this article is from the Eastern Daily Press, Saturday, August the 5th, 2023, by Mike Hicks. Some weeks ago, I did a piece on the changes in British social habits regarding home layouts and the demand for certain items of antique furniture. I deprecate the term brown furniture. There is no such thing as brown furniture. There is the most wonderful range of woods that have been grown in this country and abroad over the last 5 centuries that are still available in pieces of furniture to enhance our homes. But during the last 20 years or more, changes in our living conditions have brought about a complete withdrawal from certain types of furniture, brown or any other colour. Other changes have also taken place, possibly a bit more recently. Many modern homes, particularly the new builds, do not have a formal dining room anymore, and therefore the demand has dropped considerably. And with this, we see a drop in prices. Recently, a dealer colleague who has a shop in the Midlands where he sells predominantly china and glass put forward a theory which I think is very plausible. He said, "Mike, we are suffering from the sideboard syndrome, which means that with the demise of the dining room, we no longer need a sideboard, as eating and entertaining now is done in a kitchen, somewhat larger than has been the norm in the past. And so the need for a sideboard has gone. This then in turn means that we no longer need the items in the sideboard because they will be contained within the kitchen cupboards. As the cupboards are already full with kitchenalia of some sort or another, the surplus of china and glass comes onto the market. I do believe that most charity shops are full, and with the lack of demand, we find there is more available than we can sell. This, in turn, forces down the prices considerably. It doesn't seem that long ago when we had a wonderful china shop in Magdalen Street in Norwich that had been there for generations, that sold all the finest pottery and porcelain and cut glass you could imagine. That sort of shop has gone, as we see from the changes mentioned above. Quite what the future holds for the pottery, porcelain and glass industry, I am not sure. This doesn't mean that everything is no longer collected. There are factories and makers that are keenly sought after today, but they are very much in the minority. Also, people have collected things for the fun of collecting, and doesn't always necessarily mean that they are going to increase in value or even have a value in the future. Wherever possible, use those glass dishes and bowls, use the dinner service for everyday use, make use of quality items that were made for that particular purpose, and let's watch over the next few years what other changes are brought about by our 21st century living.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles includes openings and closings of roads and businesses.
The B1145 North Walsham bypass will be closed twice in the coming weeks for overnight roadworks. The works led by Norfolk County Council will begin on Sunday, June the 29th from 7pm until 5am for surface dressing. It will close again for further works from 7pm to 5am on Monday, July the 14th. Access to properties will be maintained. A diversion route will be in place and the closures will be only for the period needed on each date. Surface dressing, line painting and renewal of cat's eyes will be undertaken. The contract will cost £22,000 and is being handled by Norfolk County Council's Infrastructure Department. For further information, residents are encouraged to contact the County Council's Customer Service Centre at 0344 800 8020. For the latest updates on these roadworks and others in Norfolk, visit the Council's website at norfolk.gov.uk/roadworks.
A Norfolk funeral director has taken over a town's only independent family-owned service, which had been in business for nearly 60 years. Adrian Amos of Cromer and District Independent Funeral Services has acquired Goward's Funeral Independent Services in Fakenham. Founded by Claude Goward in 1966, the Fakenham Funeral Service has been in the town for 58 years. It will now continue to offer compassionate, independent funeral care in Norfolk under the ownership of Mr. Amos. Funeral Director Paul Cook, who has more than 40 years' experience in the profession, will continue in his role at the Fakenham Funeral Home. "I am honoured and excited to be taking over Goward's Funeral Services," said Mr. Amos. "It is a business with a deeply respected history and an incredible dedication to the families it serves. My commitment is to uphold the independent ethos and the high standards of care that Heather, Paul and the Goward family have established. We look forward to continuing to serve the community with dignity and compassion."
Randall's Footcare has submitted a planning application to Broadland District Council to convert a commercial unit on Norwich Road in Horsted with Stanning Hall into a podiatry clinic. If approved, Randall's will relocate its existing Coltishall branch to the new Horsted site. Randall's Footcare is a well-established provider with branches in Aylsham, Sheringham, Fakenham, North Walsham, Coltishall and two in Norwich. The business was founded in 2004 by Karen and Steve Randall, with the first clinic opening in North Walsham. The unit is located opposite the Recruiting Sergeant pub and forms part of a small commercial hub that includes Dolly's Deli, a brake charity shop and a garage. The site was previously home to a business with a similar name, Randall Agriculture. The 200-year-old business specialised in agricultural and garden machinery and closed in 2020 in the wake of a fire at its Toftwood depot. The council has set a public consultation expiry date of June the 24th, with a decision expected by July the 24th.
17 The View, Beach Road in Monsley, previously home to No. 17 Cafe and The View Restaurant, closed last June after operating for just under a year. A planning application seeking permission to convert the ground floor unit into a one-bedroom flat was granted on the basis prior approval had been given. The first floor had already been turned into two flats and a separate ground floor unit next door is also set to become a flat. Monsley Parish Council was among those who objected to the plans, citing material planning considerations. One objection from a member of the public said, "In recent times, Monsley has lost the Corner House Cafe, Jonnet Restaurant, the Manor Hotel, which all provided food and drink, both for local people and visitors. The loss of this catering facility will be detrimental to both local people and visitors. The number of premises in Monsley that could possibly be used for a catering-type business are very limited. It is understood building works have already commenced." Our last few articles cover more planning battles and a story about putting a ceiling of care onto those who sign a DNR.
The owners of an outdoor education centre have lost their High Court battle to stop Norfolk County Council building a new £1.75 million tip next to their business. Bosses at Hilltop Outdoor Centre had challenged the County Hall process, which led to councillors voting with 8 in favour, 2 against and 1 abstention, to approve a replacement Sheringham Recycling Centre on fields at Beeston Regis. Lawyers for Martin and Oliver Reed, who run the Hilltop Centre at Beeston Regis, argued in the Royal Courts of Justice in London that the council failed to follow proper and lawful processes. But following the February High Court hearings, Mrs. Justice Leven, in a judgment handed down on Thursday, June the 12th, dismissed all of the grounds which Hilltop's barristers had argued. Those grounds included that the council acted unlawfully because it failed to consider alternative sites and did not properly assess the tip's impact on children with disabilities using Hilltop's playing field, the part of the site closest to the new tip. Barristers for Hilltop had argued that the council's assessment of a potential alternative brownfield site in Stonehill Way, Cromer, was flawed, while a possible site at East Beckham Quarry, which its owners had been keen to put forward, had not been highlighted to councillors. But Mrs Justice Leven said, "In my view, the consideration of alternatives was legally adequate." The judge's dismissal of the challenge means the new recycling centre will now be built in fields next to the 30-acre Hilltop site, where hundreds of Norfolk school children head every year. It will be constructed within a designated area of outstanding natural beauty, also known as a national landscape, which the Conservative-controlled council has acknowledged is against normal policy. Martin Reid said he was disappointed with the judgment and was considering an appeal. He said, "It has come as a great shock to us because we thought we had a strong case with the evidence which we had presented. We are considering whether to appeal because this could set a dangerous precedent. This is being put on a national landscape site when there were other alternatives available, and if that can happen in Norfolk, it can happen anywhere." Norfolk County Council has been contacted for comment, but has yet to respond. The legal challenge meant construction of the new tip, which will replace the current one in nearby Holt Road, could not begin. And then in other news, the UK Secretary of State for Defence filed a sealed claim against Academy of Robotics and its owner, William Sacchetti. It is believed the dispute relates to his use of the former RAF Neatshead base, which his firm shares with the Ministry of Defence, the MOD. The Defence Secretary issued a High Court writ, which authorises a High Court enforcement officer to take action to recover debts, seize assets, or enforce other court orders. Mr. Sacchetti said, "This is unrelated to any of our current or previous dealings with the MOD, and unrelated to any radar tech which was recently announced. There was a minor dispute which was resolved, but I cannot comment on the details." Earlier this month, Mr. Sacchetti announced he was using the radar at the former RAF base near Horning as the central hub of a new communications network. He set up Academy of Robotics in 2017 using a £10,000 grant from Aberystwyth University. Since 2022, he has lived and worked at RAF Neatshead after buying the site as his company's headquarters. A Ministry of Defence spokesman said it would be inappropriate to comment on ongoing legal proceedings.
Plans to transform Bacton Gas Terminal into a carbon capture, usage and storage facility appear to have been overlooked by the government again after funding was announced for projects elsewhere in the UK. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, backed projects in Aberdeenshire and Humber in her spending review on Wednesday, having previously pledged nearly £22 billion for schemes in Merseyside and Teesside in the last October budget. Carbon Capture Usage and Storage, CCUS, aims to prevent carbon dioxide, primarily produced by industry, from being released into the atmosphere by capturing it and either reusing or storing it underground. Plans for Bacton have long been on the cards, with former Tory Prime Minister Rishi Sunak saying that there was enormous potential for Bacton to become an energy hub for the UK during a visit to the North Norfolk site in 2023. But the new Labour government has prioritised projects elsewhere, with no mention of Bacton in Reeves' review this week. Kevin Keeble, chairman of the East of England Energy Group, said, "Bacton and the East of England has been overlooked. Perenco have already gone it alone to prove the concept offshore. We will now ensure that governments see and understand our plans for how an integrated energy hub at Bacton can be a leading light in our net zero goals." Earlier this year, oil and gas company Perenco successfully injected carbon dioxide into a depleted natural gas reservoir in the Lehman gas field, 30 miles off the coast of Great Yarmouth and connected to Bacton Gas Terminal. Bacton is ideally placed for pumping vast amounts of carbon under the North Sea, Mr. Keeble previously told this newspaper. We could pipe it across from Europe or any other industrial sector in the UK. If it's going to be done anywhere, Bacton is the place to do it. The UK's Oil and Gas Carbon Storage Regulator, the North Sea Transition Authority, NTSA, recently opened nominations for potential carbon storage locations. It means energy companies can put forward areas of seabed that they hope to develop for CCUS.
Barrett David Wilson Homes Anglia submitted their plans to build 118 homes and a 60-bed care home in Cromer in April, after purchasing the 6.4-hectare site from Gladman Developments. Public records show that just over £6 million sale took place last September. Located between Overstrand and Northreps Roads, opposite Royal Cromer Golf Club, a recent amendment could see the care home expanded to enable the optimum level of elderly care. Since 2023, the plans have received 56 objections from members of the public. The site, formerly used as a golf practice area, has rewilded over the past 20 years and is now seen by many as a valuable natural habitat. The original plans were approved last year despite widespread opposition, and concerns are now intensifying as the revised application is considered. One of the primary issues raised is flood risk. The site currently absorbs rainfall naturally, and locals fear development will increase surface water runoff. A detailed objection from someone living in Northreps Road claimed the proposed drainage strategy is inadequate and lacking detail, warning it could worsen flooding in surrounding areas such as Finns Park and Station Road. Cromer Town Council echoed these concerns, stating, "The drainage system will not cope during heavy rainfall," and highlighted problems with access, traffic, and the scale of the three-storey buildings. Environmental impact is another key concern. Norfolk Wildlife Trust has objected, citing conflict with local biodiversity policy. While Natural England raised no formal objection, it insisted mitigation would be essential to protect nearby conservation sites. Strategic Housing, meanwhile, welcomed the inclusion of 53 affordable homes, 45% of the development, but raised concerns about the high proportion of one-bed units, asking for more variety and better distribution across the site. Locals have also voiced worries over increased traffic, pressure on health services, and a loss of Cromer's character. One objection stated, "This development does nothing to protect our community's future. It's a short-term investment at long-term cost." The application remains under review by North Norfolk District Council, with an internal decision expected to be made by August the 5th.
The family of a widow who died following a hip operation has urged doctors to be clearer when explaining DNR forms to patients after it resulted in her care being capped. Josephine Ellis died at the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital in October following an operation to repair a hip fracture she suffered in a fall in a car park. Prior to the operation, the 76-year-old agreed that she did not wish to be resuscitated should she need emergency care afterwards, and a respect form, colloquially known as a Do Not Resuscitate or DNR form, was completed. However, her family raised concerns after it emerged that in agreeing to this, she had also consented to her care being given a ward ceiling. This meant she would not be moved to either high dependency or intensive care units in the event of deterioration. As a result, when Mrs. Ellis did begin to deteriorate, her care was not escalated. And while this would not have prevented her death, it would have made her final hours more comfortable, Norfolk Coroner's Court heard. The hearing concluded this week, during which the family explained they were unaware of this aspect of the form. Her daughter said, "As a family, we thought that the form only applied to CPR. We did not realise the other implications of that. We think families need to be made more aware of that. Jacqueline Lake, senior coroner for Norfolk, said, "This should be taken into account by clinicians when they are explaining things." The court heard Mrs. Ellis had agreed to the RESPECT form, which stands for Recommended Summary Plan for Emergency Care and Treatment, following discussions with Rashida Begum from the Trauma and Orthopaedics team. In a statement given to the court, the clinician said, "It was my clinical opinion that she had the capacity to make this decision and she was able to retain the information. There were no concerns about her ability to understand what we discussed. Her family were present and I did not recall them having any concerns or alternative wishes. I offer them my sincere condolences and will reflect on my practice going forward." During the inquest, the court heard that internal investigations have been carried out by the hospital. Mrs. Lake concluded her death was an accident which led to recognised risk of an appropriate medical procedure. Previously, the inquest heard Mrs. Ellis had fallen in the car park of the Hoveton and Wroxham Medical Centre after attending a hearing clinic. Here, she ended up spending 2 hours on the cold, wet floor, waiting for an ambulance to take her to hospital. She was admitted to the emergency department of the NNN, where she was found to have a broken hip. The fracture was then operated on, but she did not recover and died on October the 26th. Following the inquest, her daughter added, "We want to make sure more people know about this aspect, as like us, I'm sure people do think the form just relates to not wanting chest compressions. People need to know that they will also not be going into intensive care or high dependency units, which may give them a more comfortable end. Our mum would want people to know that as well." Mrs. Ellis, who was a mother and grandmother, lived in Sprowston and was a retired soldering technician.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen using the talking newspaper skill, or you can telephone 01263 363 364 to hear the latest edition.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send your new editions each week. So please, remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Julia Bloomfield, and editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room all say hello and join us in wishing you the best of health. We look forward to joining you again in a week's time, but for now, it's
cheerio. Thank you.